Welcome back. We're in Chapter 2, The Integral Perfection, which is within the section we now call the Yoga of Self-Perfection in the Synthesis of Yoga. This particular chapter saw publication on 15th of January, 1919. A number of chapters more would be written. We'll complete this chapter tonight and do one more, and then we'll set aside the Synthesis of Yoga and move into Essays on the Gita. But these three chapters in this opening series on the Yoga of Self-Perfection, I think, declare much which is applicable to our lives here and now, all the way down to the body. So we're going to pick this up about midway through the chapter. He has reached this point where he is describing various stages of the yoga, and that to effectuate the fruit, to attain the siddhi, demands a dynamic surrender. But it is not a personal, a separate victory which is attained, but because there is a confluence of the Supreme into our own very person, that is Ishvara's victory ultimately, sustained and effectuated in us. Pardon me. So we begin. This double character of our yoga raises it beyond the mundane. This double character of our yoga raises it beyond the mundane ideal of perfection, while at the same time it goes too beyond the loftier, intenser, but much narrower religious formula. The mundane ideal regards man always as a mental, vital, and physical being, and it aims at a human perfection well within these limits, a perfection of mind, life, and body, an expansion and refinement of the intellect and knowledge, of the will and power, of ethical character, aim, and conduct, of aesthetic sensibility and creativeness, of emotional balanced poise and enjoyment, of vital and physical soundness, regulated action, and just efficiency. You'll remember Sri Aurobindo's background in the classics, his mastery of Greek and Latin, and his great regard for the Greek civilization. Of course, everything that he's written here in that long sentence is an expression of the Greek ideal of things. And yet Sri Aurobindo is from India and sees farther. It is not the summation, not the perfection of the various elements as given in our being, but an advance beyond, a discovery of the spirit, which is incumbent upon him and makes itself clear in this yoga of self-perfection. It is a wide and full aim, but yet not sufficiently full and wide, because it ignores that other greater element of our being, which the mind vaguely conceives as the spiritual element, and leaves it either undeveloped or insufficiently satisfied as merely some high, occasional, or added derivatory experience, the result of the action of mind in its exceptional aspects, or dependent upon mind for its presence and persistence. So on the roof of things for this ideal is the mind, the determiner of all things good. It can become a high aim when it seeks to develop the loftier and the larger reaches of our mentality, but yet not sufficiently high, because it does not aspire beyond mind to that of which our purest reason, our brightest mental intuition, our deepest mental sense and feeling, strongest mental will and power, or ideal aim and purpose are only pale radiations. Its aim, besides, is limited to a terrestrial perfection of the normal human life. Ah, so we would be forever a prisoner of nature as we now know her. We would never discover her secret poise and source as para prakriti, the higher nature. A yoga of integral perfection regards man as a divine spiritual being involved in mind, life, and body. It aims, therefore, at a liberation and a perfection of his divine nature. Ah, so we will discover. So you can see that he regards and embraces the world in his aim. And speaking of involution here, he implies that there will be an evolution of veiled powers, that the vehicle's action will ultimately be directed by the spirit. It seeks to make an inner living in the perfectly developed spiritual being his constant intrinsic living, and the spiritualized action of mind, life, and body only its outward human expression. This is profound. The idea that we can live continuously in this state of consciousness is contra modern psychology. Great thinkers like Roberto Assagioli, Carl Jung, etc., believed that points of illumination in our life were possible, that we can have an exalted experience of what is cosmic, what is perhaps transcendent, what is the truth of our being, but we can't reside there. We are always pulled, sort of by the gravity of the personality, back into our ordinary lives. For Sri Aurobindo, this was not theory. He went where they didn't. He began with the realization of the divine in 1908, then embraced the universe just a few months later in a widening spiritual realization, so that both transcendence and universality were part of his nature permanently. Where was his individual person? It was not negated, it was not erased, but it was sublated, it was merged, it was in communion with these other vaster states of being. The individual became cosmic, became transcendent. And yes, one can live in that, whether we have permission from modern psychology or no. He continues. In order that this spiritual being may not be something vague and indefinable, or else but imperfectly realized and dependent on the mental support and the mental limitations, it seeks to go beyond mind to the supramental knowledge, will, sense, feeling, intuition, dynamic initiation of vital and physical action, all that makes the native working of the spiritual being. So yes, he sort of conflates here the supramental nature and the highest spiritual being. But look at all that is contained in that. The supramental is not simply a vast sea of knowledge, of divine knowledge at that, but it is all this: will, sense, feeling, intuition, dynamic initiation of vital and physical action. So it is a moving, a dynamic consciousness that effectuates what Chit Shakti sees. And all of these various elements of our being are derived from that. So, our known powers really hail from that. The superlatives above have consented to become mundane here. They are secretly sourced in that. You may remember in a very early chapter in the Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo wrote about these gunas that we know as comprised part of regular nature, prakriti, as being sattva, rajas, tamas. But where do they come from? Sattva really is derived from jyoti, the divine light. Rajas is really derived from power, from tapas, the capacity of chit shakti to dwell within itself and manifest what is within. And tamas is not mere inertia, it is, in its superlative state, shama, calm, peace. So these are the things which are secretly embedded in nature and which, as we evolve out of our involved state, begin to release themselves into full and fine flower and expression. All that makes the native working of the spiritual being. So these superlatives come and dance in our nature. It accepts human life, but takes account of the large supra-terrestrial action behind the earthly material living, and it joins itself to the divine being from whom the supreme origination of all these partial and lower states proceeds, so that the whole of life may become aware of its divine source and feel in each action of knowledge, of will, of feeling, sense, and body, the divine originating impulse, as if it were a throb, a spanda, shabda, that which initiates the cosmos. Action is the divine consciousness only. It rejects nothing that is essential in the mundane aim, but enlarges it, finds and lives in its greater and its truer meaning, now hidden from it, transfigures it from a limited earthly and mortal thing to a figure of infinite, divine, and immortal values. So yes, we accept all these elements in our nature in order to uplift them, not leave them statically where they are, not in stasis, but dynamically moving upwards until they rejoin the higher hemisphere. The integral yoga meets the religious ideal at several points, but goes beyond it in the sense of a greater wideness. So he just dealt with the mundane, now he deals with the religious. The religious ideal looks not only beyond this earth, but away from it, to a heaven, or even beyond all heavens, to some kind of nirvana. Its ideal of perfection is limited to whatever kind of inner or outer mutation will eventually serve the turning away of the soul from the human life to the beyond. So we only prefer the higher. We dismiss and dispense with the lower. Its ordinary idea of perfection is a religio-ethical change, a drastic purification of the active and the emotional being, often with an ascetic abrogation and rejection of the vital impulses as its completest reaching of excellence, and in any case, a supra-terrestrial motive and reward or result of a life of piety and right conduct. So all the good that comes to us will come to us there, except for the satisfaction of living ethically here. So may we go beyond. Insofar as it admits a change of knowledge, will, aesthesis, it is in the sense of the turning of them to another object than the aims of human life, and eventually brings a rejection of all earthly objects of aesthesis, will, and knowledge. The method, whether it lays stress on personal effort or upon divine influence, on works and knowledge or upon grace, is not, like the mundane, a development, but rather a conversion. But in the end, the aim is not a conversion of our mental and physical nature, but the putting on of a pure spiritual nature and being. And since that is not possible here on earth, it looks for its consummation by a transference to another world or a shuffling off of all cosmic existence. So we would be enjoined to discard the vehicle and thus the world to escape into this lofty heaven, a heaven, whether we call it heaven or whether we say it's a rejection of the world in preference of the blankness of pure spiritual being as negatively conceived for the Atman, Brahman, or Nirvana, the blowing out of the flame altogether in Buddhism. Common to all religious paths is this extinction of life on earth as evanescent, unnecessary, and beguiling. But the integral yoga founds itself on a conception of the spiritual being as an omnipresent existence, the fullness of which comes not essentially by a transference to other worlds or a cosmic self-extinction, but by a growth out of what we now are phenomenally into the consciousness of the omnipresent reality, which we always are in the essence of our being. So you remember our reading of The Life Divine. Chapter 4 was Reality Omnipresent. And when Sri Aurobindo recast The Life Divine, 1939-1940, he gave a prefatory title to the first set of essays and called it Omnipresent Reality. So again, he comes back to that. The fullness of this reality, Purnam Madaha, Purnamidam, that chant that we begin with in our evenings or mornings together, that is full. This is full. The full is taken out of the full. Take out the full from the full remains. The Isha Upanishad is prefaced by that peace chant. Others are as well. But the Isha, the Taittiriya, and other Upanishads insist, Mundaka, for instance, the Mundaka is supposed to be for he of the shaven head, but says Brahman around, Brahman below, Brahman above. Everywhere one looks, there is only that reality, so it is omnipresent. And we are always that in the essence of our being, but the universe too conveys that spiritual nature to one who seeks, one who looks, one who penetrates. It substitutes, he writes, for the form of religious piety, its completer spiritual seeking of a divine union. It proceeds by a personal effort to a conversion through a divine influence and possession. So not the turning away, but the penetration of one into the other. But this divine grace, if we may so call it, is not simply a mysterious flow or touch coming from above, but the all-pervading act of a divine presence which we come to know within as the power of the highest self and master of our being, entering into the soul and so possessing it that we not only feel it close to us and pressing upon our mortal nature, but live in its law, know that law, possess it as the whole power of our spiritualized nature. The conversion its action will effect is an integral conversion of our ethical being into the truth and right of the divine nature, of our intellectual into the illumination of divine knowledge, our emotional into the divine love and unity, our dynamic and volitional into a working of the divine power, our aesthetic into a plenary reception and a creative enjoyment of divine beauty, not excluding, even in the end, a divine conversion of the vital and physical being. So, to live in that law, Ritta, means to advance beyond our ethical being, poised in Dharma, the right law for us according to where we are in our personal evolution, but to live according to Ritta, which is the supramental action discharging itself moment after moment, movement after movement, changing our intellectual into divine action and light. So moving from Indra, the flash of lightning and intuitive power, into what is Surya, what is the full illumination of the divine sun. And on we go. Finally, to convert the lower elements into what they truly are. But we can't do that if we don't first illuminate our consciousness. And then that cascades into mind, into life, into body. It regards all the previous life as an involuntary and unconscious or half-conscious preparatory growing towards this change, and yoga as the voluntary and conscious effort and realization of the change by which all the aim of human existence in all its parts is fulfilled, even while it is transfigured. Admitting the supracosmic truth and life in worlds beyond, it admits too the terrestrial as a continued term of the one existence and a change of individual and communal life on earth as a strain of its divine meaning. And I'm sure you're all masters of English, but the word strain here doesn't mean to work really hard or to stretch. It simply refers to a section of a melody, a divine melody. From the French and the Latin, stringere, to stretch tight, but ultimately transformed into music, so it's melodious. Huh. Note 2. Continued term of the one existence, the single reality, ekatva, oneness, and a change of individual and communal life on earth. Well, this is discoverable in the Isha Upanishad, but also the idea of a divine community, Devasangha, a community of seekers who come together and work to divinize their own personal and collective life, but also to reach that out to where it might be received well into the world around, is part of the tantric tradition and spoken directly about in the Kulārṇava Tantra. To open oneself to the supracosmic divine is an essential condition of this integral perfection. To unite oneself with the universal divine is another essential condition. And you'll remember that Sri Aurobindo, in fact, realized these two states successively. The first, in Baroda, the second in Alipur. Here, the yoga of self-perfection coincides with the yogas of knowledge, works, and devotion. For it is impossible to change the human nature into the divine or to make it an instrument of the divine knowledge, will, and joy of existence unless there is a union with the Supreme Being, consciousness, and bliss, and a unity with its universal self in all things and beings. So the self of this greatness is Atman. This greatness is itself, if we give it a name, Sat-Chit-Ananda. A wholly separate of possession of the divine nature by the human individual, as distinct from a self-withdrawn absorption in it, is not possible. So in other words, the drop can be absorbed into the ocean of light, but it cannot absorb the ocean of light into itself. It cannot swallow the whole. Nice try, Mr. Ego. But this unity will not be an inmost spiritual oneness qualified, so long as the human life lasts, by a separative existence in mind, life, and body. The full perfection is a possession through this spiritual unity of unity too with the universal mind, the universal life, the universal form, which are the other constant terms of cosmic being. So, you see, it is this kind of perfection, this kind of communion, the individual merging, saying yes to the all, not no. I exist apart from you all. I am a rock. I am an island. No. It's a wide embrace. Moreover, since human life is still accepted as a self-expression of the realized divine in man, there must be an action of the entire divine nature in our life. And this brings in the need of the supramental conversion, which substitutes the native action of spiritual being for the imperfect action of the superficial nature, and spiritualizes and transfigures its mental, vital, and physical parts by the spiritual ideality. These three elements, a union with the Supreme Divine, union with the Universal Self, and a supramental life action from this transcendent origin and through this universality, but still with the individual as the sole channel and natural instrument, constitute the essence of the integral divine perfection of the human being. So here he steps beyond the traditional yogas. This is a revision of the prospect of what we might be able to do. It is the individual that becomes cosmic, attains its meaning, and it is in the individual where the transcendent then lodges. The transversal and the horizontal representing the universe, the transversal representing the transcendent, coming down, they meet right there at that point. And that is where it all happens. So you are precious to the divine. You are indispensable. The divine cannot do this if the individual does not say yes and affirm this at every level of the nature and live it out luminously in mind, in life, and in the body, the very body. So it is an immense yoga, therefore. Huh. Sri Aurobindo's integral yoga is a cosmic yoga. It is a transcendent yoga. It demands an individual perfection. It is all that it wants. Purnam adaha, purnam idam. So that concludes the chapter, and we'll take up the third chapter next time. The psychology of integral perfection. But tonight, let's close with a section from Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 2, The Kingdom of Subtle Matter. We start on page 108. A mighty kinship is this daring's cause. All we attempt in this imperfect world looks forward or looks back beyond time's gloss to its pure idea and firm inviolate type in an absolute creation's flawless skill. To seize the absolute in shapes that pass, to fix the eternal's touch in time-made things, this is the law of all perfection here. A fragment here is caught of heaven's design. Else could we never hope for greater life, and ecstasy and glory could not be. Even in the littleness of our mortal state, even in this prison house of outer form, a brilliant passage for the infallible flame is driven through gross walls of nerve and brain. A splendor presses or a power breaks through. Earth's great dull barrier is removed a while. The inconscient seal is lifted from our eyes, and we grow vessels of creative might. The enthusiasm of a divine surprise pervades our life. A mystic stir is felt. A joyful anguish trembles in our limbs. A dream of beauty dances through the heart. A thought from the eternal mind draws near. Intimations cast from the invisible, awaking from infinity's sleep, come down. Symbols of that which never yet was made. But soon the inert flesh responds no more. Then sinks the sacred orgy of delight. The blaze of passion and the tide of power are taken from us, and though a glowing form abides, astonishing earth, imagined supreme, too little of what was meant has left a trace. Earth's eyes half see, her forces half create. Her rarest works are copies of heaven's art. A radiance of a golden artifice, a masterpiece of inspired device and rule. Her forms hide what they house and only mime the unseized miracle of self-born shapes that live forever in the eternal's gaze. Here, in a difficult, half-finished world, is a slow toiling of unconscious powers. Here is man's ignorant, divining mind, his genius born from an inconscient soil. To copy on Earth's copies is his art. For when he strives for things surpassing Earth, too rude the workman's tools, too crude his stuff, and hardly with his heart's blood he achieves his transient house of the divine idea, his figure of a time in for the unborn. Our being thrills with high, far memories and would bring down their dateless meanings here. But too divine for earthly nature's scheme, beyond our reach the eternal marvels blaze. Absolute they dwell, unborn, immutable, immaculate in the spirit's deathless air, immortal in a world of motionless time, and an unchanging muse of deep self-space. Only when we have climbed above ourselves, a line of the transcendent meets our road and joins us to the timeless and the true. It brings to us the inevitable word, the godlike act, the thoughts that never die. A ripple of light and glory wraps the brain, and traveling down the moment's vanishing route, the figures of eternity arrive. As the mind's visitors are the heart's guests, they espouse our mortal brevity a while, or seldom in some rare delivering glimpse, are caught by our vision's delicate surmise. Although beginnings only and first attempts, these glimmerings point to the secret of our birth and the hidden miracle of our destiny. What we are there and here on earth shall be is imaged in a contact and a call. Namaste. Jai Ma.